My name is James Corcoran. I'm an attorney with the Department of Energy Resources, and thank you all for coming today. It's now about 1 p.m. on June 17th, 2016, and in accordance with public notice issued by the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources, the department hereby opens the public hearing on proposed amendments to portions of 225 CMR 16, the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard, or APS regulations. This is the last of two public hearings that the Department of Energy Resources will conduct on the proposed amendments. As stated in the public notice, the proposed amendments make revisions to the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard regulations to include renewable thermal technologies and remove previous eligible technologies from the APS program. The purpose of this public hearing is to receive verbal and written comments on the proposed amendments to the Alternative Portfolio Standard portion of the regulations. As indicated in the public notice, written testimony will be accepted until 5 p.m. on June 30th, 2016. This public hearing is being recorded, and the Department of Energy Resources requests that, to the extent possible, parties also submit written copies of their testimony. If at this point in time, I'd like to introduce the rest of the Department of Energy Resources team.
Ben Donson, attorney with the department.
I'm Samantha Mazarov. I'm a Renewable Thermal Program Coordinator.
Mike Chedge, I'm the Director of the Renewable and Alternative Energy Division.
And Paul Armand, I'm an engineer.
I don't know where Howard is. But Howard Bernstein's around somewhere. He's the RPS APS Program Manager. He'll probably be back.
Okay, now we'll just all start with the comments from the those that have signed in on the comment sheet.
Yeah, so just to be clear on that, we are recording the hearing today. So I think we don't have a microphone here, but I think we just ask everyone to kind of speak up when you're testifying. So I'll call you out in the order that people have signed up. We have about 10 people signed up right now. So I think we're not going to put a time limit on anyone for right now, but if someone starts to go a little long, we might tell you to wrap it up. So, all right, so the first person we have is Mike Ferrante.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. So you don't have to stand up. Where's the recording device at?
You'd like
right in the front. Right in the front. So you can just stand right here, right in the front.
Fantastic.
Yep.
I'm going to read from some comments, if I could.
Yep.
And I'll try to summarize as well. So good afternoon. My name is Michael Ferrante. I'm the president of the Massachusetts Energy Marketers Association. We represent the home heating oil industry. Joining me today is a team of folks that are going to be coming up as well to testify. Howard Peterson from Peterson Oil Worcester, Chris LaBeouf, Falmouth Energy and Falmouth, Gene DeBolis, World Energy Boston, and Ray Albrecht from the National Biodiesel Board out of Missouri. Our organization first wants to thank DOER and the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs for the combined work in passing the enabling legislation for the APS program that we're talking about today. I want to stress the comments our team offers today on the draft documents are proffered in the true spirit of cooperation. Our comments are not in any way, shape, or form meant to delay or sideline the state's proposals or process for finalizing these rules. Our position is quite the contrary. Our industry is most eager to see the Renewable Thermal Energy Credit Program up and running as soon as possible. And as an overall statement, we are generally very supportive of DOER's work thus far. A little bit about who we are. We're the State Trade Association, once again, for the retail, wholesale, and equipment manufacturers, as well as oil heat technicians. We've been around since 1955. We represent over 300 companies statewide. Our association is also, and this is very important, the official overseer of funds that are allocated by the National Oil Heat Research Alliance that are spent here in Massachusetts on many programs, including advancing renewable fuels and biofuel technologies. Before I get to some specific comments about the regulations, I would like to talk just briefly about our progress in this area, even bereft of these regulations. I've personally been involved in biofuel and particularly biodiesel, biomass-based products, since 2002. As far back as 2004, our association sourced funds from NORC, the National Oil Heat Research Alliance, to conduct one of the first combustion energy efficiency tests on biodiesel and low sulfur oil at the Nephi School in Watertown, Massachusetts. Since that time, NORA and the National Biodiesel Board have invested over $7 million here in Massachusetts to train our industry, to advance biofuel technology, to educate consumers and our retailers as to the attributes of that fuel. Despite the fact that in 2008, DOER suspended the Clean Fuels Act, which would have enabled us to go from a 2 to 5% blend over a period of time, our industry has steadily and aggressively voluntarily embraced this fuel, biodiesel. In December 2014, we also played an integral role in advancing the specifications for biodiesel using ASTM. Our involvement, the team here today, helped push to a new standard, which is B20, B6 to B20, so ASTM now has a new standard allowing for higher blends. In addition to this, very important to note that our industry was very instrumental in helping the DEP pass a low sulfur regulation. These regulations exist not just here but around the region, but Mass was one of the first to install and institute a low sulfur program for heating oil. Right now, heating oil has to be 500 parts per million sulfur or less, and come 2018, 15 ppm or less. And that is crucial when you blend biodiesel with a low sulfur fuel in terms of its environmental impact. A report issued to Congress last year, which I will leave with you today, indicates that as little as 2% up to 20% biodiesel blended with ultra-low sulfur are, quote, lowering greenhouse gas emissions and natural gas over their full life cycle. So in terms of the regulation specifically, let me just point out a few comments we have here on the CMR. First, our organization welcomes the two-year review process DOER has proposed for these regulations. We believe this will provide the department and its stakeholders a fairly short but important time period to review all aspects of the program in order to seek improvements. Our organization is also highly supportive of the state's references and requirements that biofuels for this program meet the product spec cited in ASTM 6751 and D396. We do suggest, however, that the state add one more ASTM reference, which I just cited for you, and that is the new specification for B6 to B20 blends. That specification is ASTM D396-15C. And I will leave you a copy of that ASTM spec at the end of my testimony. With respect to the definition of eligible liquid biofuel, we'd like to point out that this wording is somewhat restrictive and could be problematic. Limiting eligible liquid biofuels to those derived from organic waste feedstocks that originate in a jurisdiction with an organic waste disposal ban in place, quote, doesn't reflect the fundamental real-world feedstock procurement and production processes of biofuel suppliers right here in Massachusetts, in neighboring states, and quite frankly, around the world. Establishing new requirements which are uncommon to the industry are likely to have an effect of limiting supply, reducing competition, and increasing costs. That said, we do support the intent of DOER's proposed definition and believe the intent can be effectively addressed at blends of 20% or higher. The Commonwealth's overall efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are much in line with the federal fuel standards and the California CARB standard, which I'm sure you're all aware of, and there are many ready established programs that we should mirror. Under the federal renewable fuel standard, which has been painstakingly defined, the words advanced biofuels, those that reduce life cycle greenhouse gas emissions by 50% or more, we suggested rather than trying to replicate the work that has been widely reviewed and was years in the making, we urged DOER to adopt the federal definition of advanced biofuels as eligible liquid biofuels. Just a few more points. Under Section 6.7, we are supportive of DOER's proposed reliance on higher levels of biofuel blending, such as 20% by volume, cited in the CMR, but we advise that the goals of the program are likely to be better served. This is a very important point for our industry. Likely to be better served by allowing compliant blends that meet ASTM D396-15C, those between 6% and B20. So B6 or B20 also should qualify. Most retail heating oil companies do not have on-site storage tanks to maintain their fuel supply. These retailers rely on large wholesale operations located in various parts of the state and out of state for picking up their product. In order to accommodate the infrastructure now in place of these wholesale suppliers of home heating oil, we suggest that DOER provide this wider range of blends that would allow the APS renewal program to be accessible to as many suppliers and as many consumers as possible. And finally, in a couple more points, in the guidelines on biomass, biogas, and biofuels under Section 11, our association respectfully requests additional information and clarification regarding the objectives and methods envisioned by the biofuel suppliers list. A highly detailed system has already been established and is already in place in part of this, is part of the daily biofuels commerce that maintains a list of advanced biofuel suppliers. Suppliers on that list are required to maintain detailed annual reporting documents, and there's also some oversight by EPA. I think that under this list, you may well be served by readily accessing what is already in the field as opposed to creating a new document. So in summary, we really want to thank you once again for allowing us the opportunity to speak. We look forward to working with you on moving this regulation forward and answering any additional questions you might have. I'm going to let the rest of our team follow, if that's how you follow the speaker, and they'll talk specifically about some other aspects of it. Thank you once again.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so next we have Howard Peterson.
Thank you for the opportunity to present my observations. First, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Howard Peterson. I'm president of Peterson Oil Service in Worcester, Massachusetts. Excuse me. I'm a lifelong resident of the Commonwealth and the Worcester community. I graduated from Worcester Academy, and I serve as the school's treasurer. I'm a graduate of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in True, New York, with a degree in mechanical engineering. I'm currently the third generation of my family to serve customers in central Massachusetts, and we have become one of the preeminent distributors of energy in central Massachusetts. Our light blue delivery trucks are a landmark in my hometown. I'm also currently the treasurer of the Worcester County Horticultural Society, third longest standing horticultural society in the United States. I'm past chairman of the New England Fuel Institute, which is headquartered in Lexington, Massachusetts, and represents all six New England states on a number of regulatory and legislative issues in Washington, D.C. I continue to represent NEFI at the PMA Marketers Association, also in D.C. I'm a current member and past board member of the Massachusetts Energy Market Association, and I'm a current board member of the Connecticut Energy Market Association. I'm a board member of the Oil Heat Institute of Rhode Island, and whose chairman is one of my employees. I'm a voting member of the ASTM, American Society of Testing Materials, whose standards for testing are worldwide benchmarks in quality and integrity. And the ASTM voted in February 2015 to amend Standard 396 to heating oil to include a table for B20 biodiesel heating blends into heating oil. I'm glad to tell you that at Peterson's Oil, we've been delivering the blends of ASTM 6751 of biodiesel to our customers for several years. I can attest that bioheat fuel oil has been introduced to our customers and has had a large number of positive effects on their lives. Blends of bioheat that are delivered within the range of the new ASTM standard help our customers reduce greenhouse gas emissions from their homes. They burn cleaner for longer periods of time, creating levels of high home heating efficiency and reduced maintenance at intervals and costs. In recent months, biodiesel manufactured from waste vegetable oil has been less expensive than petroleum-based fuel of comparable quality. This has allowed our customers to participate in the green revolution without a large capital investment in their homes. In fact, bioheat can be used in existing home heating equipment without any modifications. In addition to the cleaner air, lower carbon emissions, biodiesel manufactured from waste vegetable oil has removed millions of tons of waste from landfills and other waste streams. All this has occurred with total private investments in the New England region and has increased employment as well. As to the regulations and guidelines that accompany them, I'd like to add to the record a few of my own personal observations. My opinions are myself, and they do not represent any of the organizations for which I have leadership roles. I agree with the definition of liquid biofuel as defined in Chapter 206 Session Laws of the General Court in 2008. In Section 1602 of the proposed standard, an additional restriction has been added to the definition. The sentence, a liquid fuel that is derived from organic feedstocks that originate in a jurisdiction with a waste disposal ban in equivalent or similar to the restrictions placed on common CMO materials in 310 CMR 1903, subparagraph 3 in the table, are as determined by the departments in consultation with the Mass DEP, in my opinion, should be eliminated. The above restriction will be costly to document. It will reduce the effects of the Commonwealth to create a safer, cleaner planet and environment, because we all know that dirty air, dirty water, and global warming emissions do not stay where they originate. The General Court has passed legislation urging that we all do what we can to clean the environment and reduce global warming emissions. Limiting the collection to waste jurisdictions that indicate they agree with the General Court will only delay the day when our planet is cleaner and safer. Our Commonwealth has taken a leadership position in this issue, and these regulations should not restrict or delay the day when the Baker-Polito administration can announce meaningful progress that has been achieved in the energy and environmental areas of our economy. In addition, I recommend that in Section 6, subsection 7 of the standards, that a reference to the blend level of eligible liquid biofuels of at least 20% by volume of the eligible fuel the latest more environmentally protective standard for fuel oils issued by ASTM D396 is Table 15C, which allows the inclusion of blends of 6 to 20% of ASTM 6751. I would recommend that the APS limit the blend level to a maximum level of the current ASTM standard. Your standards may want to place a floor on the minimum blend level of 50 to 70% of the maximum level of the ASTM. However, exceeding a commercially known standard is, I'm not a lawyer, is akin to creating your own standards and your own regulations. And without background testing and other research, having a standard greater than the acceptable standard could become problematic in the commercial world. So the ASTM standard has a limit of 20%. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to reference that, but I do know that the limit. In some of the documents you reference, ASTM Table 15B, which was discontinued when we voted in ASTM Table 15C, and those are just, I think, typographical or clerical errors, but I would think when the final regulations, you would want to have all of your references correct. As I studied the guidelines and that were published on June 8th, I also found the guidance helpful, but not as clear as how the APS would be administrated. For the liquid portion of the document, it is recommended that a Massachusetts fuel dealer be approved by the department, become an aggregator for its customers, and the guideline does not describe any qualifications that person would need to demonstrate to become an aggregator. For those of us at the federal level who participate in interstate commerce, we have already gone through a process, and it might be simple for you to have this is to be a person who has a registered 637 registration number under the IRS, which demonstrates the ability to blend fuels, the ability to store them, and the IRS has done a pre-qualification. You may want to use the federal qualification standards, or you want to maybe develop your own, but as of right now, you have not defined them. In practical applications, I believe, is that you're going to find that the last person you will be able to audit would be the fuel oil dealer actually delivering the fuel. It's unlikely that you'd be able to audit the percentage of fuel that would be in any single home in the Commonwealth on any given day as being unpractical and not measurable. And these small generation standards take that into account. But I would think that the audit area and the aggregation area would stop at a dealer level, which in my opinion is the last place where you can audit the results. In practical applications also, when you look at the producer level, the producers are all registered with the federal government. They use the EMTS standard or protocol, which is set up by the Environmental Protection Agency to track RINs, which are the renewable identification number, which goes into every gallon of liquid renewable fuel. Tracking the credits for the AFS with a RINs number will be problematic because the 32-digit identification number for RINs, the D letter, sub-character number 6, uses the federal definition of advanced biofuels, which is different and more a broader definition than the Massachusetts definition. So following the RINs numbers would not necessarily achieve your goal because this number 6 of advanced biofuel, the difference in designation between Massachusetts and the federal government. However, it provides a base for an audit stream. So how you would determine that from a supplier point of view, what fuel is made from waste vegetable oil as opposed to other advanced biofuels is something that you did not describe in the guidelines. And I would be very interested to see how you would propose to do that and also have an opportunity to comment on that. But the federal government, the EPA does run the EMS system. It's up, it's running, it works. However, the caveat is that the EPA does not guarantee that this is audit proof. The audit obligation is still between the buyer and the seller of biodiesel. And I'm paraphrasing some of the things I've written because they were kind of technical, and they referred to the paragraphs within your guidelines. One of the other areas is some of my notations are based upon the page numbers of when I downloaded it and actually printed it, but your pages weren't numbered, so we followed the designations as best we could. But I believe that the producers will need to have an undue burden in an audit stream as you go forward, but you did not designate how that would be done. And we would hope to have the broadest possible inclusion of as many manufacturers of advanced biofuel as is possible with the least amount of audit or special procedures, because that just drives up the cost to every consumer in the Commonwealth. I would request that as you make these guidelines more, as you improve the guidelines and you publish more details, you would give us an opportunity to comment on future editions of the guidelines, this being the first one. And in closing, I just want to commend you for bringing this program closer to implementation. I look forward to standing shoulder to shoulder with you as we demonstrate to the world how we in Massachusetts can have a dynamic, clean, green, and thriving Commonwealth. I myself have made a significant investment already in creating green jobs and bringing my products to be environmentally cleaner, meet greenhouse gas emission standards, and we have done that all with private investment, and we look forward to working with you in the future and expanding that investment. We encourage you to do everything on your part that you can assist the residents of the Commonwealth to become greener, cleaner, healthier, and maybe wiser, but I'll stop at healthier. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. All right. So next, and I apologize if I say this wrong, Gene Gebelis?
Very close.
Okay.
So my name is Gene Gebelis.
Yeah.
I am the president and CEO of World Energy. We are a producer, distributor, and trader of biodiesel, and have been for quite a long time. We're based in Boston. We have production assets in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Mississippi, and a large-scale distribution center on the Ship Channel in Houston. I think everybody knows that Massachusetts is an innovation-driven economy. I think it's less well understood how much my colleagues in the home heating oil industry have been part of that innovation for many generations. Most of these folks are people who are descendants of people who started out delivering ice for ice boxes or coal once electricity came in, then to heating oil, and then gradually transitioned to lower sulfur heating oil, and now into bioheat, which contains a subset of 100% renewable biodiesel. What's even less well understood is those folks have been driving and are continuing to drive innovation in energy is how much Massachusetts has been a part of the biodiesel story. Biodiesel, the first standalone biodiesel business in the United States started in 1994 in Quincy, Massachusetts, Twin Rivers Technologies. You know, Howard remembers. World Energy is a spin-out of Twin Rivers and effectively has been operating for 22 years based in Massachusetts, innovating in biodiesel all along. So because we are here, and because Paul Nazaro, who has been working for the National Biodiesel Board, also out of Massachusetts, and really creating the bioheat industry, has been here, the basis for biodiesel and bioheat and the emergence of biomass-based diesel is really a Massachusetts innovation story, and it's something we should be proud of. As we are moving into this next step, and the DOER is promulgating these regs, this is a great first start. The draft that you put out is a tremendous first start, and it's really encouraging that we will really be able to potentially drive that innovation that's been happening for generations into a whole new era in which home heating oil in Massachusetts contains ultra-low sulfur diesel and biomass-based diesel blends combined. It has the potential to really drive innovation to even lower emissions than we're getting from natural gas, and to take what is often thought to be an old-line industry and move it even cleaner than the cleanest home heating applications we have in the United, in Massachusetts, in the Commonwealth. As we're doing that, I think it's important that we not try to recreate the wheel. The success or failure of this program is going to be based on how much the Commonwealth can take the tremendous amount of work that has happened over those 22 years that I just referenced and encompass it and incorporate it into your regulations. And if we make the program too ambitious, trying to define too specifically exactly the outcomes we want, we'll get the opposite. I think if we take the work that has been done at the federal level and at various other state levels and copy it as much as possible, we'll find that the answer already exists for some of the questions that are asked in the proposed rules. First, the definition of the material. I've been producing biodiesel for most of my adult life. I have sourced it from every known feedstock in every known location around the world. We have bought it from every corner of the world. We have sold it in every corner of the world. We have produced it in most corners of the United States. We know what feedstocks are available and how they're available. The regs, as proposed, I think, are trying to get to the right objective. I think that the objective implicit in the regs is that we want to make sure in Massachusetts that we're creating bioheat that is truly environmentally friendly and truly creating the lowest carbon footprint possible. That is absolutely the right objective. The path to getting there, though, might be counterproductive. In the federal regulations, which I've been actively involved in overseeing the development of from their origin, the renewable fuel standards identify advanced biofuels as those fuels that can be proven through the EPA to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% or more over their alternative. Those are every single advanced biofuel registered with the EPA has been through tremendous vetting that took years to arrive at. The EPA also keeps detailed lists of specific companies under which this registration requires that these companies continue to update their environmental and engineering compliance forms annually. For us, in our manufacturing plants, that requires us to bring in external engineering firms to vet what we're doing at these plants annually. And for every other advanced biofuel company, it requires the same. So I'm not entirely sure what the objective behind maintaining a list was, but I know that lists exist. And those lists, as proposed in the regs, maybe we're trying to get at a different objective, I'm not entirely sure. But lists exist. What I'm encouraging you folks to do as you're finalizing these regulations is to, as much as possible, piggyback off of what exists. And I will tell you, from having been involved in them from their absolute first days, the federal program is a highly detailed one and well worth copying. More recently, the California Air Resources Board has been evaluating various types of feedstocks for biodiesel and biomass-based diesel and have recently changed their carbon intensity numbers to incorporate more updated information about how various feedstocks play into the mix. That is also valuable information that could fit into what you're trying to accomplish here. The last thing I want to talk about is the importance of the blend rates. So there long has been this notion that higher blend biodiesel or bioheat contributes more than lower blends. In my view, that is incorrect. What we're trying to do, or what should be trying to do, is displace as much fossil fuel with as much renewable fuel as possible. Not on a per delivery basis, but in an aggregated basis. So if a push towards higher and higher blends gets fewer and fewer participants, we end up at the wrong, arriving at the wrong place to meet the objective. If lower blends means more and more and more participation, and it does, then you arrive at greater total displacement. So the objective, as it relates to a carbon footprint, relates to total displacement, not on a per delivery displacement. As such, I would echo what Howard Peterson said before me, which is to say we ought to adopt standards that are consistent with other standards relating to home heating burners and the like, in which ASTM has already set a standard between 6 and 20, and it would be very wise to mimic that standard. That's still higher blend levels than is found in the 0 to 5 levels in diesel fuel. At up to 5% in diesel fuel, you don't even have to label biofuel content. Above 5%, it must be labeled. And the ASTM standard that Howard referenced earlier is the standard that goes from 6 to 20. So I think, in short, you're absolutely on the right track. I think this can be an extremely successful program. Extremely successful, as Howard said, in moving within existing infrastructure from fossil-based fuels to completely renewable-based fuels, and fuels that have been proven to dramatically reduce carbon footprint. But the devil's in the details. And I would ask you to think hard about not trying to make it up here in the Commonwealth. We've innovated in so many ways in the Commonwealth. But sometimes the best form of innovation is imitation. And I would ask you, where possible, to imitate the federal standards to help us innovate here in the Commonwealth. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. So next we have Ray Albrecht.
I'm Ray Albrecht. I'm a technical representative for the National Biodiesel Board, which is a trade association for biodiesel producers, distributors, and even some of the end users that are out there. It's a very eclectic group of people. So I just want to point out, this is not your standard trade association of manufacturers exclusively. It's a very broad-based group. So I cover New York, New Jersey, and New England. I've been very active, and this has been a great experience working on behalf of NBB to help bring renewable energy to Northeastern United States. By way of background, I spent 30 years at NYSERDA, which is the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. I was the manager of their fuels, combustion, heating equipment research program for 30 years. After that, I retired for about 2 months, okay, and then the phone rang, and I started working again, including for NBB, and here I am still chugging along, okay, but it's a labor of love to be working on behalf of renewable energy. To echo what some of the previous speakers have said, yeah, biodiesel really offers a great opportunity for you folks, for us collectively as a community, to accomplish our goals of achieving a sustainable energy future. We speak often of the goal of 80% or more greenhouse gas savings by 2050. Biodiesel in the thermal sector, especially, as well as for power generation and transportation, offers us a very practical way of getting there. And, you know, we're ready to go. In terms of, you know, where it stands compared to heating oil, we talk about that all the time, okay? I just want to bring to your attention that even compared to natural gas, okay, biodiesel offers a chance to leapfrog our way to higher efficiency. Biodiesel does achieve about a 70% greenhouse gas savings compared to natural gas right now, and the numbers continue to get better as the farmers become, you know, more efficient in their operations. So I'll get into a few technical comments and then wrap up. Guidelines and regulations currently call for neat biodiesel, which theoretically or purely means B100. I'd encourage you to use B99 so that biodiesel that has gone through the blender's tax credit or hopefully soon the production tax credit process at the federal level can qualify. Okay, that's a technical argument. Okay. In terms of the feedstock requirement question, there's been a lot of work done at the EPA RFS2 program level. We've made a lot of headway in terms of both how we analyze biodiesel from a sustainability perspective, and also the industry has responded to that. And we've addressed some of the more contentious issues, such as rainforest, destruction in the Pacific countries and South America. We have addressed those questions squarely. The agricultural community, like I said, is also making a lot of progress. In terms of understanding the sustainability of renewable fuels, we often have fallen into the trap of thinking it's food versus fuel. And I'd have to say in the case of ethanol, which has become a real, I would say, villain recently, that in part can be true. With vegetable and animal fat-based fuels, though, such as biodiesel, it really is a question of food and fuel. Okay, let me just go into what that means. When you grow soybeans or canola oil, you have to remove the oil from the beans before they can be fed to animals. Okay, that's because they cannot digest high concentrations of oil. And that was really the original genesis of making biodiesel, is that we had a waste product that we needed to find a useful home for. Okay, the general principle is that when you grow a crop that also can be a source of energy, that the higher the percentage of the output or the product of that crop that goes to food, and the lower the percentage that goes for oil, the higher the overall basket of economic value will be. Okay, and so I guess I would encourage you in the case of heating fuels to be thinking in terms of food plus fuel instead of food versus fuel. And that can be hard to distinguish, especially when, the media is out there touting all sorts of arguments that, may sell newspapers or whatever, but may be a bit far from the truth. So, in terms of the feedstocks, therefore, you've already heard, the EPA and CARB, California have made a lot of progress. I really would encourage you to build upon what those folks have done, especially over the last couple of years. The Massachusetts definition of statute now, that's information based on information that's a good 10 years old. It really is in need of updating. And we'd be more than happy to work with you in that regard. So, my role really is to provide technical assistance to state agencies and NGO, environmental groups. And I guess the closing remark that I would say is be more than happy to help you, especially as a past colleague to, DEP and DOER staffers. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. So next we have Chris LaBeouf.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris LaBeouf. I'm the owner of Falmouth Energy. My business is a small retail fuel and service company. We're located in Falmouth, Massachusetts. We serve customers in Barnesville and Plymouth counties. I'm very excited the state of Massachusetts is looking to advance the use of biofuels at the consumer level. I believe these regulations have potential to make a significant impact on the use of biofuels and the subsequent environmental benefits that result. Falmouth Energy has been at the forefront of reducing customers' environmental impact for many years. In 2012, we started a vision to provide our residential and small commercial customers with solar PV and solar thermal installations. Through this process, we've worked closely with the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, the DOER, to bring dozens of solar projects to fruition. In addition to solar energy, in 2015, we also began distributing our customers' bioheat fuel at a low blend level. Our experience has shown us the tremendous value and importance of advancing adoption of renewable energy sources. As a small residential fuel supplier, I want to see the regulations that will allow all dealers, both large and small, to have the opportunity to participate. I believe the current program guidelines will make it difficult for many smaller suppliers, such as myself, to participate. The first issue is limiting to a B20 blend. Although we would all like to be at this ratio currently, reality is that this blend is not readily available for most small retailers. The other area I'm concerned about is potential administrative burden. Most small retail fuel companies don't have the necessary staff to handle excessive reporting. A streamlined and automated process will go a long way to reducing this burden and hopefully increase support and participation in the program. Again, I applaud the state's effort to increase the use of liquid biofuels and look forward to seeing a successful program that will allow all retail fuel suppliers the opportunity to participate. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next, we have Garrett McGuire.
Thank you. Shift away from biofuels for a second, if that's okay. My name is Gary McGuire. I'm the manager of state government affairs for the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. It's the trade association representing more than 300 manufacturers of quality, safe, efficient, and innovative residential, commercial, and industrial air conditioning, space heating, water heating, and commercial refrigeration equipment for sale in North America and around the world. AHRI's members account for more than 90% of HVACR and water heating equipment manufactured, sold, and installed in North America. Additionally, the HVACR industry, through our manufacturers, distributors, and contractors, supports over 22,000 jobs in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. On behalf of AHRI, I would like to thank the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources for the opportunity to offer public comments on DOER's recently released regulations for the Commonwealth's Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard. As you know, the Massachusetts General Corp passed legislation in 2014, paving the way for renewable heating and cooling technologies to qualify for renewable energy credits under the Commonwealth's APS. As the trade association representing the manufacturers of highly innovative and advanced heating and cooling technologies, we are delighted to see the DOER has included air, ground, and water source heat pumps as an eligible technology. Our members produce highly effective and efficient heat pumps, and the incentive to use these technologies will be an added benefit to Massachusetts residents and businesses. As the regulations are being finalized, we also encourage DOER to include air-to-air energy recovery technology. This well-developed and tested equipment provides significant benefits to energy reduction and building performance. In fact, AHRI's ERV product section is one of our fastest-growing sections with 36 manufacturing companies to date. These companies include national leaders in heating and cooling equipment production like Carrier, Ingersoll Rand, Lennox, Nortec, Trane, and Mitsubishi. Air-to-air energy recovery ventilation equipment uses the naturally occurring temperature difference between indoor and outdoor air to precondition outdoor ventilation air, thereby reducing the workload and energy consumption of a building's HVAC system. Ventilation systems are responsible for approximately 30% of a commercial building energy usage. ERV can decrease this usage by more than 50% by lessening the load on heating and cooling equipment. We believe ERV technology falls under S2214's definition alternative energy generating sources through the energy recovery ventilation units, which employ air-to-air heat exchangers to recover energy from exhaust air for the purpose of preconditioning outdoor air prior to supplying the conditioned air to the space, either directly or as a part of an HVAC system. Specifically, ERV technology should fall under Category 4 of the alternative energy generating source definition in S2214, as ERV is driven by a naturally occurring temperature difference in air, namely that between the building exhaust air and the outdoor air. The temperature difference between building exhaust air and outdoor air is a naturally occurring temperature difference in the same sense as it is for other technologies, such as an air source heat pump. By including internationally recognized ERV technology as an alternative energy generating source, Massachusetts will continue to be at the forefront of policies that promote environmentally responsible energy use practices. Massachusetts will be looked to as a national leader in promoting promoting improved public health and the reduction of GHG emissions. Again, we applaud the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for taking a leadership role providing alternatives to traditional energy consumption, and we encourage the Department of Energy Resources to consider air-to-air energy recovery technology as they finalize the state's alternative energy portfolio standard. We look forward to serving as a resource for DOER in this and future rulemakings concerning the heating, air conditioning, water heating, and commercial refrigeration industry. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, next we have Charlie Neebly.
Sorry, I came in late. I apologize. And, someone must have signed me up. thank you. My name is Charlie Niebling. I am here today representing New England Wood Pellet, a manufacturer of wood pellet fuels headquartered in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, with facilities in Jaffrey, Schuyler, New York, Deposit, New York, and Youngsville, Pennsylvania. And we're the largest manufacturer of wood pellet fuel in the Northeast. And our fuel is used strictly to supply domestic heating markets. We do not export fuel to Europe. We, as far as we know, none of our fuel is being used in co-firing. It's being used entirely to generate thermal energy in homes, businesses, institutions, commercial, and industrial facilities, both space heat and process heat. I also chaired the Massachusetts Renewable Thermal Coalition, which was a coalition of about 45 businesses and organizations that worked over a period of almost 2 years to bring this policy concept forward and see it through to enactment by the legislature in the summer of 2014. And I'm very pleased to see a draft of the rules that we can now see how the rubber hits the road with the policy that was enacted. I'm going to submit detailed written comments, and if you'll bear with me, I'm just going to kind of go through a few technical details and rules. I don't have prepared comments today. The first, I don't know if you're following along with a copy of the rules or how I should reference the section of the rules, but what would be, I don't have page numbers on my copy, unfortunately. The section small generation unit annual net useful thermal energy determination. I want to suggest that with particularly in the context of solid biomass combusting units that you consider increasing the threshold from the current 340,000 BTU or 100 kW to 200 kW for systems that can qualify for I forget exactly the terminology that you use. But anyway, I'm quite familiar with the implementation of the thermal provision in the RPS in New Hampshire. And the experience that we've observed in New Hampshire is that it's a real lift for smaller residential, small commercial systems to comply with the requirements, both the technical requirements and the administrative and compliance requirements for qualifying your heat output for thermal alternative energy credits. And to Massachusetts' great credit, you made provision for a mechanism whereby smaller systems can be pre-qualified for a certain conservatively estimated heat output over a period of time and then receive the equivalent value of those RECs in an upfront single one-time lump sum payment. And I want to suggest that you consider increasing what is defined as small from 100 to 200 kW, and then what you define as intermediate from 100 kW to, I believe it's 300 kW, I'm used to thinking in terms of watts, to 200 to 500, and what constitutes large and would require the full back-end BTU metering from 300 to 500 kW and up. I just think it's going to make the RPS in general more accessible to a wider range of and diversity of potential qualified applicants, and that ought to be the objective of these rules. I think the 100 kW limit that you set for small is too low. And I will elaborate on that in my written comments. Next page, you've got a section here that says fuel quality. Eligible woody biomass fuel shall be produced using only clean wood and meet fuel quality specifications with regards to moisture, ash, and chlorine content. First of all, Nowhere in the rule is the term clean wood defined, and I would suggest you contemplate a definition of clean wood so that there's no ambiguity about what is meant by that term. We already know it can't include C and D, fine. No issue there, but what does it mean? And be happy to work with you on that. Also, you reference the requirement of specification around chlorine content, but there's no limit identified in the biomass guidelines for chlorine. It's got overlooked. And I would suggest you consider the limit that is pretty universally recognized in pellet fuel standards here in the U.S. and around the world of 300 parts per million as a limit to consider. Sections small Roman 3, greenhouse gas emission reduction. The main concern I have here and question I have here is that the determination as to whether your system can exceed a 50% or greater greenhouse gas emission reduction goal, I have no problem with that. But it's all based on life cycle analyses that are not in the rule, and I don't know where they reside. And what are the metrics, what are the protocols, what are the assumptions that go into those life cycle analyses? How far back in the supply chain and the do you go? And if you go far back, let's say, for example, speaking hypothetically for wood, into the harvesting of the wood in the forest, then are you also going to go back to the extraction of the crude from the ground in Saudi Arabia, or the extraction of the natural gas from Marcellus Shale in north central Pennsylvania? And what does that whole calculation look like? Because this is a really important part of the regulation, and yet it's not in the guideline, and it's not clear what the basis for these comparative LCA analyses is going to be. So that one really deserves to be fleshed out in more detail, particularly as it relates to biomass. Did you put a time limit on speakers?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, I went to Longwood instead of Longwood Medical. So I'm sure people have made that mistake before. Can I ask questions?
No.
No, okay.
Provide comments on the proposal.
Understood. Yes. Okay. That's it on the regulation, and then I have a couple questions on the guidelines. Middle of page 3, third paragraph under biomass sustainability, fuel suppliers will need to document the chain of custody from the forest to the retail supplier and on to the end customer. I would suggest you provide some guidance on what your expectation is there so that everybody's on the same page about documentation of chain of custody or whatever level of detail you're looking for. Okay, I have a question on the middle of page 4, fourth paragraph. A mass balance approach is a means of accounting for the flows of material using a defined, etc. I think I understand what this means, but I'm not entirely sure. What I hope it means, and let me just back up and say, in the case of New England wood pellet, at any point over the course of the year, our fuel is manufactured from anywhere between 80 and 100% non-forest residues. This is sawdust, chips, shavings, grindings from lumber manufacturing, furniture, flooring, cabinetry, and millwork. So it is the byproduct of other wood product manufacturing. At the present time, it's 100%. Typically in the wintertime, we purchase a small amount of what we call roundwood bulk chips from sustainable forestry operations. And my question is, if we produce 90,000 tons of fuel a year in Jaffrey, under a mass balance approach, does at least 80% of that qualify for or meet the definition of a qualified sustainable fuel in Massachusetts, even though at some point in time there may be a small amount of roundwood chips blended into the feedstock going into the manufacturing process? Is that what a mass balance approach means? It's making some provision for commingling of different types of feedstock that some of which, in our case, most of which, and certain times of the year, all of which, is not subject to all the sustainability criteria by rule. But for a portion of the year, a small amount of it is subject to the requirements that you impose on fuel suppliers, on wood suppliers. So that's, I'm not entirely clear on that, and maybe I should have reached out to staff in advance of this hearing. But I hope what it means is at least 80% of our fuel meets the definition, by definition, meets the requirements by definition. And the small amount of roundwood chips that we do purchase in are not necessarily subject to these requirements. But I'll look for elaboration on that. Okay, last item. And I'm going to take my New England wood pellet hat off for a moment and strongly urge you to consider expanding the definition of chips to include chip fuels that exceed 30% in moisture content and may have a thermal output efficiency at high heat value of less than 75%. Because it seems to me what you've done is discriminate based on pretty fundamental laws of thermodynamics. Green chips are less efficient than pellets or dry chips because they have a higher moisture content and a certain percentage of the inherent energy in the wood is necessary to convert the liquid water in the wood into a vapor. So they shouldn't be discriminated against simply because output efficiency is lower. There's a widespread misunderstanding about that issue. And why it's important is because if you allow systems to qualify using what we call a green chip, something over 30% moisture, you open up this opportunity to a much wider range of suppliers. It will have greater and better economic impact in the state. It will be of greater potential benefit to landowners and wood suppliers across the state and around the region. And it is a less costly fuel to heat with than pellets or chips. And I'm coming from a pellet manufacturer. I just think this regulation ought to be ecumenical with respect to solid biofuels and not draw what I consider to be an arbitrary and unnecessary limitation based on moisture content. Keep the emissions requirements. And what that means for a green chip system is they're going to have to install an electrostatic precipitator to meet that 0.1 pounds per million BTU. They can't meet that level without sophisticated back-end controls. Fine. We want these systems to be clean. But I would not discourage against green chips for the reasons that I mentioned. I mentioned that you need a chlorine standard in the guideline because the rules require one. I could say a lot about thermal storage, but I'll save it for my written comments. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. So next we have Stephen Coffin.
Good afternoon. I'll be brief. I have just a couple of general comments. Steve Kaufman from Clean Asset Partners Corporation. We represent renewable energy system owners in Massachusetts' renewable energy certificate markets, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the draft alternative portfolio standard regulation. I support the draft regulations framework that differentiates metering requirements by categories of system size. I think DOER's proposed approach will substantially increase the viability for a number of small project types to participate. And I'd also like to express support for the forward minting provisions for small projects and pre-minting in years where that would not be expected to alter the market's supply and demand dynamics. I think that framework also would help to enable a number of small project types to participate. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next we have James McCaffrey.
Hi, thanks. I had a little bit of a, we'll call it a debate with my printer this morning, so
that's okay.
My notes off my computer here. And my name is James McCaffrey. I'm here commenting on behalf of Partnership for Policy Integrity. We offered some comments the other day at the hearing out in Western Mass. Thank you. And we have some more detailed comments to offer today, and we'll also follow up with written comments. So let me open this up here and walk you through it. As we noted the other day, our big concerns with respect to these regulations are related to the promotion of wood pellet use and the expansion of that industry, not only in Massachusetts, New England, but also nationwide. So I wanted to walk through some concerns that we have related to CO2 emissions and life cycle analysis, air pollution and other emissions, some of the sustainability concerns, and some of our views and concerns that others have shared that there's a failure to comply with some other acts and regulations with respect to how these regulations are proceeding. So our big concern up front with respect to pellet usage is that there's no life cycle CO2 analysis for pellet usage in the regulations. While they are simultaneously promoting, would promote the use of wood pellets as fuel. So we think that there needs to be a life cycle carbon analysis done to determine the carbon pollution impacts, so that we're not forced into some kind of false trade-off between other air pollutants and CO2, because as currently drafted, if you're promoting the use of pellets compared to burning green wood, you might have some reductions in some areas, but you will actually get an increase in CO2 emissions. Massachusetts' own data, particularly the Manomet study that was conducted, did look at both thermal and conventional use of biomass. It did not actually look at pellet use, but it did conclude at the end of the findings in that report that the net emissions from biomass thermal units will be higher than fossil fuel units for a similar sized unit. So this is a case where you actually need to look at what the overall CO2 emissions are going to be. The other concern related to this is that there's no time frame. I think someone else mentioned this earlier, but there's not any meaningful time frame for looking at the analysis. So, for example, the regulations under the RPS have a 20-year time frame, which require biomass electricity facilities to reduce net emissions compared to fossil fuel units, but there's no time frame in these proposed changes. And just as an example, if you have at time zero, the emissions from biomass are being assessed as stack emissions, and then after 10 years, just using it as an example because there is no assigned time frame, they're assessed as stack emissions minus whatever regrowing forests have sequestered, you could come up with some meaningful number for what the carbon emissions are. But if you have no time frame, there's no way to assess what the actual net emissions are from burning biomass and burning wood pellets. On the sustainability front, we have some concerns about the harvesting and types of wood. Our organization has FOIA'd the past data on this related to the enforcement of the existing RPS regulations and the eligibility for the electric generating units for biomass. And the data is very difficult to get, interpret, and to analyze because it is so there's so little data that the state is collecting essentially on this front. So if you don't have good quality data on what you're doing for sustainability and harvesting practices, you can't really assess what the impacts are of the program. So we'd like to see some improvements done there. And again, a lot of this is about trying to match up with some of all the other really great work that Massachusetts has already done on this front on the RPS side, which is what I had mentioned the other day, and trying to sort of bring these into line with that. The regulations don't have any information about the impacts on soil carbon stocks. There's an increasingly growing concern about the loss of soil carbon from logged forests, and about 50% of the total ecosystem carbon may actually be stored in soils. And logging releases much of this carbon, some of it immediately and then some more over time, and this is not addressed at all in the regulations. On the air emissions front, there is not any meaningful provisions in the proposals to address the potential of heavy metals that would appear in pellets. And the Commonwealth has actually done some good work on this already in addressing this issue with EPA. DOER has commented on the risk of heavy metals and pellet use. Your own website, the EOEA's website, has some really good information for homeowners up there burning pellets that not all pellets are the same. In 2013, there was a NYSERDA study that I think it was called the Elemental Analysis of Wood Fuels, and it found a huge variation and in some very high values of heavy metals in wood pellets, and the study concluded that there was basically an inability to track pellet material and heavy metal contamination in these products. So you need to do some work on that front to try and make sure that we're not actually putting out significantly higher amounts of heavy metals and pollutants into the air because we're burning pellets. And then finally, just talking about how the emission standards do not seem to match other state protections or actually even comply in some ways with Chapter 251, Section 2. On the particulates front, the emissions control requirements seem to be weak, and we'll provide some high level of detail in our written comments on this and how it doesn't seem to match up and comport with other protections that are needed elsewhere and outlined elsewhere, both in the APS and the RPS. And with respect to the Act itself, I think this was noted at the hearing the other day, and we want to reemphasize that there has been no study conducted for sustainability on forest practice. There's no standard definition for sustainability, and the Act itself actually says a couple things that I think are really important to highlight. That facilities using biomass shall be low emission, use efficient energy conversion technology, and produced by means of sustainable forestry practices, and that DOER, in consultation with DEP, shall set emission standards that are protective of public health. This gets back to the particulate matter and the air emissions and not matching up. And that DOER, in consultation with DCR, should develop requirements that fuel provided by this means be conducted with sustainable forestry practices. To our knowledge, this hasn't occurred yet, so these regulations seem to be out front of those practices. And I also mentioned the other day that the latest development that the SJC also required that DEP would adopt regulations for aggregate sources and have declining emissions over time. And that also is a new development that it seems like this would be kind of ahead of, that you're going to be issuing a new regulation here that has the great potential to increase CO2 emissions in the Commonwealth and in the region, and we haven't adopted those regulations that DEP will now be required to adopt. So we feel that it's obvious that there's been a lot of really hard work put into this. It's a really complicated and complex issue, and we feel that it's just a little bit of the cart before the horse, that there needs to be some other provisions that move forward first. There needs to be some studies done, and there needs to be some really good thinking put in to what happens next on this front. Because as I mentioned at the hearing the other day, we've been such a leader on this front, and the world is looking to us, and we're at a tipping point here. And I don't know if folks noticed, but for the first time ever in Antarctica, carbon levels were measured at more than 400 parts per million. Because folks keep thinking about this sort, and there were a lot of comments at the hearing the other day where folks were talking about Massachusetts and New England and carbon and sequestering carbon. This is not a local or a regional issue. What we do here will have a significant impact. We have commitments under the Paris agreements. A standing forest is absorbing carbon. A forest that is cut down is not absorbing carbon, and for any meaningful time frame, you will be emitting more carbon at the stack than even fossil fuels if you start ramping up a massive pellet industry in the United States that wants to actually replace coal boilers nationwide in order to comply with the Clean Power Plan with pellet burners. we will have a significant increase in emissions in the United States. And this is a phrase that I don't think I've ever used it, which is sort of the camel's nose under the tent. We've done such great work here, but this effort to try and ramp up a pellet industry starting here in Massachusetts and New England could present a real danger and a real precedent and undo all the great work that many of you have done here in Massachusetts to try and deal with this issue and actually be at the forefront of the science on this. So thank you for all that work that you've done, all the work that you've done to try and pull these regulations together. We think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. We recommend that the woody biomass actually be removed from this effort right now until we can get some of this other work done. I don't know if you can move forward with the other components of the regulations and pull that part out and separate it out, but it just seems like there's too much work to be done to allow this to be included in the regulations at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have one more person on the actual official list, but then after that we might be able to have more people if time permits, which it looks like it probably will. So the next person, the last person, is Kathy Buckley.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Buckley. I chair the Massachusetts chapter of the Sierra Club, and I speak on behalf of our 50,000 members and supporters across the Commonwealth. And I thought I'd only have 3 minutes, so I'm not going to talk for very long, but I left out almost all the details that we will be submitting in our written letter to you. And I'm also going to talk about this in the context of the bigger picture, some troubling trends that I'm seeing here in Massachusetts that I want to address. And this is in the context of the big threat, which is climate change. I've never heard a climate change scientist say, oh, things aren't going to be as bad as we thought. It's quite the opposite. And I think if you go back and look at the IPCC reports and then go forward, you'll see that the timetable is creeping up. The city of Boston just did a study which suggests a 2-foot sea level rise by 2050. And I can just imagine what that estimate is going to be in 2026, 10 years from now. And that assumes no large ice chunks coming off of Antarctica or Greenland. So I want to address three concerns. What is real clean renewable energy? What is real complete information? And who really does this administration serve in terms of climate energy issues? To the first, we can use solar power directly from the sun, which is being sent to us in real time, but instead we insist on digging deep into the earth to excavate fossil fuels, energy that the sun created millennia ago, process them, and then burn them. And we can cut down trees, that's energy that was created by the sun decades ago, and process that, create pellets, and burn them. Mother Nature can help us out of the mess that we've created. So what is Massachusetts doing with all of her offers? I think this administration is, the fact that we may be cutting down more carbon sequestered trees is very concerning. The fact that we're putting, and again, I'm going into, parallel areas, but the fact that we're putting caps on solar power at a time when we should be pushing it as quickly as we possibly can. We have a 1% renewable portfolio standard. We need at least 2 and perhaps, much more than that. Governor Baker's advocating a procurement of a little over half of what is estimated we need to make offshore wind a viable, thriving new Massachusetts enterprise. 2, we also need real information. If the administration, for example, supports electricity users paying for pipelines, meanwhile, the leaking methane, both here and in the fracking fields, is threatening our chances to meet our Global Warming Solutions Act mandate, something which the Supreme Judicial Court just indicated is a real legal mandate. And we are talking about procuring big Canadian hydro without factoring and, in fact, ignoring the fact that a new dam, if we're going to be enabling a new dam, it's going to be a net loser on climate for the first 20 years because we'll be submerging large areas of forests and creating massive methane releases. Forests that today, again, are carbon reservoirs. So the biggest issue and the biggest question for us really is what is the total impact of this proposal on the mandate of our Global Warming Solutions Act? And the third issue is who is really being served by these regulations and proposals, you know, both here as well as in the omnibus energy bill that we're dealing with right now in Massachusetts. The Sierra Club feels that we're failing to act on the opportunities that could make Massachusetts a world leader, that really could increase our share of the real clean renewable energy sector. For example, why are electric ratepayers being asked to subsidize the pipeline industry when the pipeline industry itself doesn't want to subsidize its own pipelines because, of course, it's too risky? Why do we want to shackle the offshore wind industry at a time when studies say that the majority of our energy by 2050 could be from offshore wind here in Massachusetts because we have such an incredible resource south of Martha's Vineyard? And why do we want to cut down more of our trees and increase prices for New Englanders here? This proposal appears good in many ways for the industry, I not necessarily good for our economy and for our health. And please consider the entire picture, not just what's happening today, but what implications this is going to have for our economy, our health, and that of our children in the future. Thank you.
So with that, we've actually gone through the whole list of everyone who signed up for testimony. If there's anyone else that would like to testify, you're free to come up now. Yep, come on up. And just state your name and the affiliation.
Sure. Joe Sheffley with Mitsubishi Electric. Just prepared a few things to mention here. So representing variable speed inverter-driven air source heat pump technology. First, I'd like to applaud the DOER and the state of Massachusetts for being so proactive in developing this important piece of legislation. It is truly groundbreaking and will undoubtedly set the groundwork for programs in other states. We intend to submit written comments at a later date here with detailed information referencing sections of the draft and much more detailed information. My purpose of commenting here today would be to mention at high level the observations that we've made in reviewing the current draft. So I'm not going to dive into details here or reference sections, but just rather give general observations. So for variable speed air source heat pumps, the categories are broken into three different sections: small, medium, and large. And in reviewing the draft specification, it looks like the small category has a requirement for 100% heating capacity. So basically, system sizing has to be such that it can meet 100% of the design load and or with other renewable technologies in order to meet that total design load. So currently, an issue I see with this is that the vast majority of these types of small inverter-driven heat pumps are being used for displacement rather than replacement. So they're being used, for example, if you've got a 3-ton furnace, someone's putting in a 1 or 1.5-ton air source heat pump in order to displace as much fossil fuel as possible rather than replace, because the cost return on investment for replacing the entire furnace capacity is diminishing returns. In order to meet, you know, those few run hours where it's extremely cold, it's cost prohibitive to use that large of an air source heat pump. So in this example of the formula, you could adjust the multiplier for the heat pump, for example. In the small formula, it uses a 3 for the multiplier. You could adjust that multiplier down to account for the fact that you're not doing 100% of the heating run hours. So maybe have a sliding scale. If it's a 1-ton furnace and you, I'm sorry, a 3-ton furnace for the application, and you use a 1-ton air source heat pump, maybe the multiplier would be a 1. If it's a 2-ton versus a 2-ton air source heat pump versus a 3-ton furnace, maybe you can use a 2. So, you know, it would account for the amount of actual kWh displaced in that application. And our real concern here is having success of the program and having commercially available equipment that people are actually going to install and qualify for the program. Our feeling is that with the 100% requirement, basically nothing's going to qualify for the program, at least the way things are being done at present. Intermediate category, intermediate size. It doesn't indicate the interval, so is it yearly? I'm assuming it's yearly. In the small category, it says yearly. You calculate, you know, your aches per year. And then in intermediate, it doesn't seem to say if it's yearly, quarterly. I'm assuming yearly, but clarification on that matter. But also, there isn't any listed criteria for eligibility in the intermediate category. So do all variable speed air source heat pumps qualify? In the small category, there was the requirement to meet the NEEP cold climate air source heat pump specification, as well as that 100% system sizing requirement that mentioned previously. So those two together are some relatively restrictive requirements, and then the intermediate category doesn't appear to have criteria at all. Lastly, the large category. In the large category, it looks like for variable speed air source heat pumps, they've diverged between conventional air source heat pump and a variable speed air source heat pump, inverter-driven, whatever you want to call it. The inverter-driven heat pump seems to require a flow meter in the refrigerant in order to do your real-time metering BTU calculations. As far as I know, I've been a mechanical engineer dealing with this technology for approximately a decade now. And as far as I know, I don't know of any products that would... I just don't know if there's anything available to actually do that, if that's practical. If you look at the way that the proposed draft is doing it for a standard air source heat pump, they're looking at BTUs being rejected by the condensing unit. Delta T across the condensing unit, as well as the airflow of the condensing unit, and a watt-hour meter on the power going into that unit. Therefore, you got BTUs out, power in, and you can subtract out the net amount of new energy that went in and find out your COP effect, essentially. So for some reason, with the inverter-driven air source heat pumps, it was looking at, from a refrigeration system, a flow meter like you would do on a chiller system. I don't know if those exist for refrigerant. Just doesn't appear to be something I've ever come across in my experience. And that is it.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else? All right. Seeing no one else. Okay.
So, the public hearing, technically, we will stay here till 3 o'clock. If anyone has additional comments, we will at this time, we'll turn off the recorder and we'll close the